Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's a great place to do some networking, but we've got a really full agenda, so let's get started, and we can do the networking later during the breaks and the lunches. I want to welcome everybody to the Oregon Single Payer Conference. I don't know about you all, but I am extremely enthused and jazzed about this conference, that we're putting it on, and that all of you are here. So please give yourselves a hand for showing up. Now, I just learned something a minute ago that's a little bit of bad news and a little bit of good news. So the good news is there's about 600 people registered for this conference now. The bad news is there were only 200 pre-registered, so that's how many lunches we have. So if there's someone here that knows a loaves and fishes trick, come and let us know. Otherwise, the options are the following. If you pre-registered, we have a lunch for you. If you did not pre-register, we do not have a lunch for you. And either we're going to share or we'll disperse ourselves out in the street and find some of the food carts and something. But we'll find a way, I'm sure. This is starting to feel a little bit like Woodstock, you know. In any case, I want to thank all of you for being here. We should thank, before we get started, and we'll do some more detailed thank yous later, but the Presbyterian Church for putting the money on the table, the Unitarian Church for letting us use their facility. We need to thank all of them. And the main co-organizers of this conference, Physicians for a National Health Program and Jobs with Justice, without whom we couldn't have got any of this done. So thanks to them. Now, they thought single payer was going to go away if they ignored us. And they've been trying pretty darn hard to ignore us, haven't they?
Yes. But...
Who are you, Paul?
Pardon?
Who are you, Paul?
Yeah, exactly. Who am I? Well, I'm nobody, but we collectively are somebody.
And we're not going anywhere. Some of the medical students looked up all the organizations that are a part of or have sponsored this, and collectively we represent 100,000 Oregonians. That's pretty substantial. Beyond that, there are 17, you wouldn't know it if you follow the commercial news industry, but there are 17 states in the United States that have single-payer legislation, which has either been passed already and the governor's vetoed it, or is in the legislature across the country. So single-payer isn't some, you know, remote, forgotten thing. 17 states have single-payer in the progress like us. So that's fabulous news. Logistics-wise, important news. The bathrooms are downstairs. Signs are in the lobby. And I just want to go over quickly our agenda. So we're going to start out with a couple of plenary sessions. I'm sorry?
We're not going to get away with anonymity.
Oh, who am I?
Who are you?
I'm nobody. My name's Paul Gorman.
Thank you.
I've been an Oregon physician for 25 years.
Elevator,
if you need the elevator to get to the bathroom, it's downstairs. My name's Paul Gorman. I'm a member of Physicians for a National Health Program. I'm one of the maddest held doctors, but not one of the genuine ones that's really out there on the field. I just try to support him from Portland, I guess. And I'm like the rest of you, we want to achieve justice in healthcare. That's why I'm here. I hope that's why you're here. So the program, we're going to start off with some plenary sessions. Dr. Margaret Flowers has come from Maryland to tell us about single payer and the national scene. We're going to have a panel to talk about the struggle for equity and how this healthcare chaos we have in the United States really harmfully affects certain groups of us more than others. Then we're going to we're going to have a break, and we're going to move into some breakout groups to work on how we can move forward. If you look in your schedule, you'll see what those breakout groups are about, and we'll make an announcement later. Just for now, though, if you're interested in the homelessness and poverty group, it's a room change. It's room 202. Then we'll have lunch, and lunch is all about networking and thinking about how to move forward. Following lunch, we are honored to have Representative John Conyers from Michigan, a national leader in single payer. followed by the Mad as Hell doctors, who are going to tell us some lessons from the road. Following that, Katie Robbins is here from Healthcare Now, and she's going to help us get started for and then get into some working groups. And at the end of those, we'll have a final wrap-up session to talk about lessons learned. And I want all of you to be thinking today about homework. This isn't the goal here isn't just to preach to the choir. We're in a church, of course, but we're already pretty much on board about single payer. The goal here is for us to leave today, every one of us, with an action plan for single payer. How are we going to get the ball to move down the court so that Oregon and eventually the nation can have single payer in place? So that's the goal for today. I hope you all can leave today with that kind of action plan in place. So to get started, let me introduce Dr. Margaret Flowers. Margaret, come on up. Dr. Flowers is a pediatrician from Maryland. She's the Congressional Fellow for Physicians for a National Health Program. And as you all know, she's a national leader in the search for justice in healthcare. Margaret, please take over.
Good morning. It's great to be here. It's great to see everybody. And here we go. Sorry. Find my gadget. Here we go. All right. So I met Paul the first time right after I came off tour with the Mad as Hell doctors in their 2009 tour. He met me in D.C., and we went to the White House and broke the law. You didn't tell him about that? We put white ribbons on the White House fence. You're not supposed to do that. We wanted to do something. So I've been tasked with teaching you everything you need to know about single payer, the new reform, and what's happening in D.C. in the next 30 minutes. Right? So there's a lot of stuff I'm going to leave out. And you know that if you want to learn more, you can go to our websites, go to pnhp.org, go to healthcare-now.org, and learn more about what's going on. But I'm going to try to give you a general idea. All right. So I'd like to start out with a little bit of history, and sometimes this slide jumps. We'll hope that it doesn't. But it's good to put things in a little bit of a historical context. I picked out some, you know, this could be a whole talk, the history of healthcare reform, but some kind of salient points. In the 1940s, World War II, the United States had a freeze on wages. And so we started tying health insurance benefits to employment as a way to attract employees. We're the only nation that does that. In Europe, as a result of World War II, they went in a very different direction, and because of the huge devastation and poverty there, created an anti-poverty package that included national health insurance. But this is kind of a jumping off point of departure between the other Western industrial nations and our nation. In the 1960s, there was a huge belief in the market that the United States was unique. We didn't need a national health system because we had this very unique insurance, private insurance market that if we just let it go, it would cover everybody. Obviously, that didn't happen. But I think the 1980s is really a fundamental time of change in this country, because that's when our tax dollars were actually used to bring investment groups into the Department of Health and Human Services in Washington, D.C., and train them how to take on health care as a profit-making venture. And so this is when we saw this shift in our language. We started talking about patients are consumers. Like, they're not patients anymore. I remember when they were still patients, but now they're consumers of healthcare, and healthcare was starting to be treated as a commodity. And we started trying to fit medicine into this business model with these for-profit corporations and hospitals, you know, in charge of our healthcare. So I think it's important to be aware of that. I try to use language that does not feed into that mindset, because that healthcare is not a business. Health is not a commodity. Patients are people, not consumers. All right, I guess I have to point it. Whoops, that way. Okay, so just a few quick things that you need to know. The United States excels in one area, how much we spend on healthcare. If you look at this chart, it shows you at the top the United States compared to some of the other industrialized nations. You can notice that in the dark red bar part of the United States, that's what we spend in public dollars on healthcare per person per year. This is actually 2008 data. Currently it's about over $8,000 per person, but the proportions are the same. So we're already spending more in public dollars per person in the United States than these other nations are. They cover almost everybody. They have better health outcomes. They have higher patient and physician satisfaction in those countries. If you add in our private spending, in many cases we're spending twice as much per person. So it's not a matter of money. We're already paying for universal health care. We're just not getting it. And this slide, I apologize that the graph is not the same as the top, because I don't have an updated slide, but it does show you kind of the upward trend in the uninsured. And you can see how it starts jumping off in the 1980s. And it's just continued to go up. The 2009 census data shows us that almost 51 million people in the United States now have no health insurance. And a big part of that jump was people with jobs, people who lost their jobs and then lost their employer-sponsored health insurance as a result of that. We actually had a bump of 10 million people in 2009, newly uninsured. That's the highest jump that we've seen ever since we started keeping this data. But fortunately, almost 6 million of them were able to get onto public programs. So the overall change was just a little over 4 million. But still, that 4 million alone is the biggest jump we've seen. So, I got to remember how to do this. Okay. We're spending a lot of money. We're not covering everybody. We're also not getting a lot for our healthcare dollars compared to other countries. And this shows the UK, Canada, Australia, France, Denmark, and Japan, the number of physician visits per person per year, we're at the low end there. We're also at the low end in terms of our usage of healthcare services in general. So we're paying the highest prices, we're spending the most money, we're leaving people out, we're not getting a lot of healthcare services for our dollars. And we're not doing so well. Our health outcomes rank us 37th in the world in areas like infant mortality, maternal mortality, we're ranked very high, 2 to 3 times more what we see in other industrialized nations. Life expectancy is not doing well. And this is a study I think is important to look at. This looked at 19 industrialized nations that could be compared and said if each of these nations operated as well as the top three, how many deaths would be prevented? And the United States was the worst. If we operated in one of the top three, we would save over 100,000 lives a year in this country. So, you know, in the United States, we always like to be proud of being the best. Why aren't we trying to be the best in healthcare? Why are we settling for less than that? And this is an important concept that I think I like people to understand. This is a little bit of health policy stuff, but there's something called the 80-20 rule. If you look at a population of people, 80% of that population is relatively healthy, and 20% of that population uses the majority of the healthcare dollars. But that 20% is fluid. Any one of us can fall into that 20% at any time. So what single payer is all about, what our current situation is all about with the private insurance is who are they competing to cover? The bottom 80%, right? They have a lot of administrators working to ensure that bottom 80%. In single payer, if 100% is in the system, if 100% is paying in and we're sharing the cost of health care, there's a system there with enough money to cover each of us in our time of need. And that's what single payer is about. So this is important to understand why we spend so much. This graph shows the rise in physicians over time. And I want to compare this to the rise in administrators over time. So if you look, that's 3,000%. What are all those people doing? This is the problem with our healthcare in this country. These people are developing health insurance products. It's a product. They're marketing those products. Then we have to have all the people that decide what are the different products, which one do you want to buy? Then you buy it. Then you need care. You got to figure out where can you get your care. Then you get your care. Who pays what proportion? This is an incredibly wasteful way to finance or administer health care. No other nation does it this way. So we waste a third of our health care dollars on this stuff. That's about $400 billion a year that could be used to pay for actual health care under a single payer system. All right, this is an important concept for you guys to know. Have you heard of consumer-directed health plans? They're all the rage right now. About half of our plans that are bought on the individual market are these consumer-directed plans. There's this whole concept of skin in the game. You have to have skin in the game. If you're not paying for your health care up front, you're not going to make good decisions. Like when you get hit by a car, you're laying there and you're thinking, I need to get on the internet and look up which hospital does best for my broken leg, right? So high deductibles, high premiums, co-insurance, these health savings accounts, which are financial products. They're not really meant, you know, it's another financial thing. These are under insurance products. These products put each of us at risk for bankruptcy, personal bankruptcy, if we have a serious accident or illness. And if you look at, this is a cycle I love to go through. This is where we are right now as a country. So look at the top. Every year, insurance premiums go up, right? So then you are pushed into purchasing a premium with lower benefits. So then you have more out-of-pocket spending. We know that co-pays and deductibles keep people from getting necessary care. So you decrease your use of health services, which means, oops, I didn't control my high blood pressure and I had a stroke. So now you have a more serious problem, which means your premiums go up even more. And this is what people are doing right now. They're riding the cycle till they fall off. But in terms of the bankruptcy, this is a study from 2009. It showed that 62% of the personal bankruptcies in this country are due to medical illness, medical cost. And almost 80% of those people that went bankrupt from medical illness had some sort of health insurance. So Katie Robbins has a great phrase that I like to steal from her. She says, health insurance in this country is like an umbrella that melts in the rain. When you need it, it's not there. All right, so what did we get for the $938 billion that we're going to spend over the next 10 years for healthcare? The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act was based on what's called the mandate model of healthcare reform. It's been tried before. Massachusetts is the most recent experiment. It's based on an expansion of Medicaid and then mandating that people purchase private insurance if they don't qualify for public programs, and then using tax dollars to subsidize the purchase of that private insurance. So that's tax dollars going to the insurance companies. And then in exchange for that, the private insurers said that they would accept regulation, right? Because they've done so well when we've tried to regulate them in the past. It's more of the same. And actually, I was in California a couple weeks ago, and this Dr. Jim Kahn down there, who's a researcher, said that, you know, when you do a research experiment, you know, in a hospital or in a medical institution, you have to put it to the ethical review board first to get approval. And one of the criteria is that you have to be asking a question that nobody knows the answer to. He said if we put PPACA before an ethical review board, it would fail because we already know the answer. This reform has already failed at the state level, and it's going to fail at the national level. What is the impact of the legislation on the uninsured in this country? Well, the initial estimates in 2009 by the Congressional Budget Office were that it would leave 23 million people still uninsured when it's fully implemented in 2019. Since that data information came out, there have been higher estimates. And if we look at state data in states that passed reform, and they always would say, well, we're going to cover this many of the population, none of them ever achieved that goal. So we expect it's going to be more than 23 million. New report is saying that even in 2014, when the exchanges kick in, there will probably be 30 to 40 million people with no insurance. So we're still leaving tens of millions of people out. They're also cutting the funding to our safety net hospitals. This is very concerning. This was tried in Massachusetts. The rationale was that when everybody's covered, you won't need all these safety net hospitals. And they found the opposite in Massachusetts, and now some of those hospitals are suing the state. The one bright shining star in this legislation, from my viewpoint, is the increased funding for community health centers, because in this time of our community health centers are really needed. They're overflowing with patients. They're having to turn people away. What about the underinsured? Well, the president during the reform process kept saying, if you like your insurance, you can keep it. And that was supposed to make us feel really great. But what it didn't tell you was that if you don't like your insurance, you have to keep it. And so if you have an employer-sponsored plan, you have to keep that plan. And the tiers, you know, there's going to be different tiers of insurance that you can buy based on how much of your health care costs it's going to cover. And because there's no real control of health premiums, it's going to drive more people into those lower tier plans that cover maybe 60 or 70% of your costs. So if we look at, you know, what's considered affordable, a $7,000 premium with a $2,000 copay, I mean a deductible, and then co-insurance, this is $10,000 out of pocket that you're paying just right off the bat, and most people just don't have that when they need it. All right, so health reform. We're still for it. We haven't gotten health care reform. We got some health insurance reform, but we didn't get health care reform. So this is going to continue to leave people out. It's going to increase our total spending. Actually, surprisingly, there was so much talk about deficit neutrality, but after the reform was passed, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services said that as a result of the reform, our health care costs were going to rise faster than if we had done nothing at all. So that's concerning. It's due to, in part, because of the increased administrative burden of this reform. We're likely to continue our trend of underinsured. We know that employers are also looking at the opportunity to dump their employer plans. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal where businesses were saying, well, nobody wants to be the first one to dump employer-sponsored insurance, but we're all going to be, rushing to be second. So that's concerning. The mandating is that we purchase private insurance, but there's no guarantee that that insurance is going to take care of us when we're sick, which is very concerning. And it restricts our choice. You have to choose private insurance, which restricts where you can go to get your care, what physicians you can see, and what care you can get. All right, so after decades in this country of trying this model of reform, we know what the outcomes are. It's expensive. It leaves people out. We're going to probably hear more about the health disparities. We have growing health disparities in this country. It's causing our primary care doctors especially to leave practice. This is very serious, and it's growing the number of uninsured and underinsured. Just to mention about what did we see from the reform process. Well, I think it couldn't be any clearer after this reform process that this was heavily influenced by the corporations that are profiting off the status quo. And it was just so blatant that, looking at the ads that they aired, if pharmaceutical companies are in support of the reform, it's probably not good for us. The actual white paper that was the original paper for this reform was written by Liz Fowler, who was the senior vice president of public policy at WellPoint, one of the largest insurers in the nation. She then, in the Senate Finance Committee, was responsible for overseeing the health reform process in that committee. And then as soon as it passed, surprise, she got appointed to the Department of Health and Human Services to oversee the regulation of this. So this is direct industry involvement, as well as we know the lobbying that was done by the industry around this legislation. So we got it. I was worried before the reform passed that after it passed, everybody would say, oh, look, they did it. Yay, they achieved health reform. Let's all go home. No, we saw what happened. We saw that this was an industry-written reform and that if we want real reform, where is it going to come from? It's going to come from us. We have to make it happen, and that's why we're all here. I'm glad to see you guys here. So, one of my favorite comics, this is an airplane that represents the U.S. health insurance system. Gosh, we tried every reform they'd let us try. It's just not getting off the ground. All right, so what did I learn from the national process? Three things. And fortunately, it falls into the initials ICU, which in the medical world stands for intensive care unit. So we're in a crisis, we need ICU. We as a movement must be independent of political parties. We cannot be allied to a political party, because when you do that, you subordinate their agenda to your agenda. So as a movement, we've got to be independent. We have to be clear about what we want. And this is where education comes in. Education is so important because words get used in different ways. This reform was PPAC, it was called universal. It's not universal. It was called guaranteed and affordable, but it's none of those things. So we have to be clear on what those things mean and uncompromising. We can no longer settle for reforms that we know don't work. We've got to push hard for what the real reform is. All right. So what is single payer? You guys probably know this, and we'll do single payer 101. But the basics are it's a single risk pool, everybody in, nobody out. It means that people contribute to healthcare based on their ability to pay. We're the most regressive of the nations in the way that we finance healthcare, so that people with lower incomes are paying a higher percentage of their income for healthcare. We need to reverse that and get rid of co-pays and deductibles, because all they do is cause more administrative burden and they cause people to delay or avoid necessary care. We need to cover all medically necessary care. There's no reason why an entity should profit off of necessary care. If you want to profit off of other elective things, I don't have a problem with that. But if someone needs their care, they need to get their care. Simplified administration. We know that single payer, we can streamline it. One set of rules for patients, for healthcare professionals. It costs much less. Choice of physician and treatment in the system everybody's in. You choose where you get to go. You and your doctor or other health professional decide what treatment you get, not an insurance administrator. Focus on preventive and timely care. Timely as we remove financial barriers, people can actually go get the care they need when they need it and have better outcomes and hopefully cost less. And then finally, we demand accountability and transparency in our healthcare system so that we know where our healthcare dollars are going. So this is the pool, that an NHP fund, that's the pool. And what we do is we take our healthcare dollars, our federal, state, local, some employer contributions, some other taxes, all that goes into the pool. And then out of the pool, that goes to pay for the healthcare, for the infrastructure. 80% of our healthcare costs are staffing, equipment, buildings, goes to pay for that, goes to pay for the individual care, including long-term care. How can we afford this? We know that single payer has proven cost controls, and we have numerous studies, and this is based on a study that was done in California for the state, just showing that the increased cost of covering people who aren't getting care and of removing the copays and deductibles is more than offset by the inherent cost controls in single payer of global budgeting for hospitals, so they get the money they need to care for their population. So no longer are small community hospitals going to go out of business. They have the money that they need to take care of their population. Of creating in this country the ability to actually negotiate for fair prices for services, pharmaceuticals, and devices. There's a great article by Uwe Reinhardt called "It's the Price is Stupid," because in the United States we have no negotiating ability to negotiate for these prices, and that's why we pay the most. So we can actually create savings through a national health program. All right, we have what it takes. We've got great hospitals, well-trained professionals. We've got great research. We are spending enough money. So I'm going to go a little bit into what's going on now with the movement. Let's see. There we go. So Paul said 17 states. I have 20 states that are in some phase of single-payer legislation. And I know that North Carolina, I'm heading down there in a couple weeks. They're going to introduce legislation. And do I have New Jersey? New Jersey also. I was out there not too long ago. They're looking at it. So more than 20 states that are looking at state single-payer bills. One state that we're very excited about right now is Vermont. Have you guys been hearing about Vermont?
Yeah.
Keeping up with that? Yeah. So we haven't seen the legislation yet. We have seen the proposal that they put together. The proposal needs some improvement to give it some of the cross controls that we want to see from a single payer bill. But they're continuing to push in Vermont, and we need to continue to let them know that we're hoping that they can lead the way and pass single payer for our nation. There we go. What do we need to do? Education. As Paul said, it's not enough for us to know about this. We've got to take it out of here. So here's a very simple rule. If every single one of you can talk to one person a day, one new person a day about single-payer health care, we can really spread this. If you have a group that you belong to, bring single-payer to your group. Bring it to your family, your workplace. Everybody needs to know about this. Don't be afraid to talk about it. Building coalitions, that's so great to see that this was a PNHP, Jobs with Justice, and all the other groups that came together, because it's really going to be, this has got to be solidarity of the groups. This is about social and economic justice. Any group that's concerned about social and economic justice, we should all be working together to make this happen. And then some interesting projects that are going on around the country, putting some pressure on health insurance companies. If there's some divestment campaigns, there's a shareholder resolution campaign going on against WellPoint to force them to look at becoming a nonprofit. These are some creative ways. I think the divestment campaign could really be an exciting way for college campuses to get involved. I was in college in the 80s with the apartheid, anti-apartheid movement, and I know that really got us involved. So that's kind of a neat idea. And then, you know, it's striking to me how many people don't even understand what health justice is, or when they're being treated, you know, with health injustice. They don't realize that premiums going up out of control, that being denied care, that, you know, having been kicked out of the emergency room, you know, without the proper care that you need. These are all health injustices. Doctors being fired because they're spending too much time with their patients. Nurses being forced to take care of too many patients. These are all health injustices that are occurring. Community clinics that are closing down. Community hospitals that are closing down. So these are opportunities for us to expose what's going on in this country, to show that this is wrong, that this doesn't happen in other places. Other industrialized nations do not have this situation. We're abnormal. And so these are all opportunities to build solidarity in your community, to fight for health justice, and to make the point that single payer would change that situation. So I think I'm almost done. Yep, here we go. So why aren't we trying to be the best? Why don't we try to go for a national improved Medicare for all? It's the patriotic thing to do, right? So thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you throughout the day.
Thank you so much, Margaret. That was fabulous, as always. I don't know anyone who puts all those facts together any better than Dr. Margaret Flowers. It's time to move on, and I was thinking as she was talking, there's so much complicated politics, economics, and so forth, but it's fundamentally simpler than that in this sense. 45,000 people, that's the number to keep in mind. 45,000 people die in this country every year. Not because we can't figure out what's wrong, not because we don't know how to fix it, just because we don't have the will to do it. And it's a simple moral question. If someone's dying and you're there and you can help them, you should. Very hard to argue with that. Someone's dying, I'm there, I'm capable of helping them, I should do it. And in the United States, right now, 45,000 people die every year. It's more than breast cancer, it's more than prostate cancer, it's more than kidney disease, and we can help them, so we should. And I thank all of you for being here to do that. Our next group is a panel. We're going to talk about how this inequity especially affects certain groups in our society. I want to welcome the panel up, if you wouldn't all mind coming up here. The panel is going to be moderated. The panel will be moderated by Marco Mejia. He's the co-chair of Portland Jobs with Justice Immigrant Rights Committee. Marco has been a leader in Portland immigrant rights movement for many years, helping organize the massive May Day demonstrations of 2006. He works on helping educate the community around immigrant workers' struggles. And joining him on the panel are Michael Ware, Jessica Lee, and Alberto Marino. I'll let them introduce themselves and tell you a little bit about the struggle for health care and health care justice.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I'm proud today to tell you that I'm an immigrant. And one of the basic things that we see here is that we are missing the whole thing about understanding healthcare. We need to understand, and the government needs to understand, and the politicians need to understand, and many of us need to understand that healthcare is a human right. That's the way it should be looked at, right? Not the other right that corporation wants, you know, the right to get profit out of it. So to start, I think that with that one, I want to tell you that the broken system hits some people harder than others. But as usual in this country, in many others, but especially in this one, race and class are key indicators of that, of health. Healthcare. And immigrants, if you, many of you followed the debate for the reform, the health reform, if you follow that, we are the first on the list in terms of exclusion. And those were pretty heated debates, and very nasty things were said about immigrants, and that we don't deserve anything like that. We need to understand these issues if we are going to build a movement that includes everyone as we fight for single payer. And that was said. Thank you to you. That's very important. If we need to leave out our agendas, our, you know, group agendas, organizations' agendas, and really look at healthcare as a human right for all of us. And if we're not together, we're not going to accomplish something like that. Especially now, these corporations are very strong and they're very united. And if we're not united, we cannot get anywhere. There's a logical, natural alliance in building a coalition between single-payer advocates and advocates of health equity. Single-payer, well, not the only step necessary to create equitable health outcomes, thus create more equal access to care, a big step towards those equitable outcomes. At least one big step, and we need to do it, as we were saying today. And we need to do it, right? Yeah. And if we're here, it's because we want to do it, and we are going to do it. And that's very important, to make a commitment. There are several collaborations of people of color organizations working on health equity in Oregon. The People of Color Healthy Equity Collaboration has been uniting organizations based in different communities to advocate for inclusion of equity standards in statewide reform, as well as economic measures to reduce inequalities. The Racial Equity and Prevention in Healthcare Collaboration, including several other people of color organizations, is examining legislation for these sessions from a racial equity lens. We're lucky to get to hear from these fine activists and organizations about the inequities faced in their communities, in our communities. So today we have Jessica Lee. We're going to welcome Jessica Lee as the first-generation Korean-American research analyst with APANO, which is the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. We also have Michael Ware, policy coordinator for the Oregon Health Equity, and Alberto Moreno, migrant health coordinator for Oregon. And let's give them a welcome to class for Oregon.
Well, I guess I've been chosen as the first one to go. I don't know if it was by popular vote, but... So where is my little... Oh, there we go. Good morning, everybody. So my goal right now is to not put you to sleep, more than to educate you. let's see if I can... There we go. So my name is Jessica. I'm a research analyst with APANO. So what I want to talk about today is a little bit about... I should have said more about health disparities in our Asian Pacific Islander communities. And so you'll hear me say API, which I'm going to try to shorten that from Asian Pacific Islander Americans, Native Hawaiians, Pacific Islanders. So the first one, this is an assumption on my part, and I'm, you know, of all people should not be making assumptions, but equality versus equity. Do we know what the difference is? I don't know. For a long time, you know, we always talked about equality, I think. And just recently, I feel equity has been a trendy word. But really, there is a definition to equity. And I think our founding fathers never really thought about the difference between equity and equality when they wrote the Constitution. So we have person A, and they face this wall. It's a barrier. So let's let it represent whatever barriers you can think of. Person B, they face the same barriers. But this person has a shackle and handcuffs, so they have additional barriers. So now we're trying to use this as representative of communities who face major barriers to access. Now what these two both need to cross over that wall? Can you think of anything? Ladders, ropes, right? So they both get ladders. But the person on the left cannot cross over that wall on that ladder because they've been shackled and they don't have, you know, the means. They can't use their hands because they're handcuffed. So what does that person need? They need more, right, to get over that wall. They need a saw, maybe, to cut off that shackle. It'll take them a really long time, but they can do it. And they need that key to get their handcuffs off. So the difference between equity and equality is that the latter, they have equal access, right? Because that means that they can both get over, well, technically, if he wasn't shackled down and handcuffed, then they can both get over the wall. But this person facing more barriers needs more in order to get over those barriers. So equity really means more input, if it's necessary, for the right amount of input to get equal outcomes. So that's what we're trying to get to. So this is a picture of health disparities in the API community. If you look at it, the black text, I don't know if you can see it very well, Black text is national data. There's very little specific data on specific subgroups of API subgroup communities. So if you look at this, I mean, there was a story on NPR about a Vietnamese-American woman who went to the doctor, and the doctor said, "You cannot have breast cancer because you are Asian." So, but surprisingly, U.S.-born Vietnamese-American women have 4 times a greater risk of dying of breast cancer than any other group. Surprising, isn't it? Highest rates of late prenatal care by 30.1%. Korean children, right? We hear a lot about, you know, Asians who succeed in society, you know, who are in the news, and you talk about middle minority. But Korean children have 4 times, you know, they're less likely to have insurance, health insurance, and they're children. Then you look at hepatitis B rates, 3 to 8 times higher. And then we see 3 to 8 because we don't have specific data about specific, you know, which groups are 3 times, which groups are 4 times more likely to have hepatitis B. Now the white text, this is Multnomah County for the API groups here. So Asians have almost 2 times the homicide rate of whites. And this is surprising as well for modern minority myth, right? In 2007, tuberculosis was 24 times more common in Asians. Tuberculosis, that's preventable, right? You can get vaccinated for that. Oh, the one thing that I really wanted to point out, 47% increase between the 5-year period in 2000 to 2005 in new AIDS cases diagnosis among APIs. 47%, that's the highest increase of among all racial groups. So what are the barriers to health for API? So what I wanted to start out with is social determinants of health. We've all heard this in this whole conversation about health equity and health reform in Oregon, and how we want the new exchange to, what we want it to look like, what we want reform to look like. So social determinants. So this is very, very basic. Excuse me. When we talk about social determinants and what it starts with, I start out with poverty at the top. We say poverty because generally that is a major access barrier, right? But in our country, it's been historically people of color who have been poor because of historical racism. So when we talk about low educational attainment and survival, trying to meet basic needs, all leading up to poverty because, you know, you can't send your kids to school if you're busy trying to meet your basic needs and feed them. That cycle, you know, you live in poor neighborhoods. So social determinants, where we live, where we eat, where we play, where we pray, where we go to school, those are all determinants of our health. If you're living in a poor neighborhood, there's no parks, you have very few resources, high rates of violence, high rates of crime, then you're not likely to go out and play. You know, if there's, you're more likely to get kidnapped or shot. You don't want to do that. You know, and you have very few parks. You don't want to be going out walking if you don't feel safe. Transportation is a huge issue, especially if you're living in poorer neighborhoods. Then all of this leads to social isolation. So there's a major lack of access there because you don't have access to what you need through your community, through your networks, through your relationships. And so that our children aren't engaged in schools because of social isolation. So then you have low educational attainment, low income levels because of low educational attainment. So it's a vicious, vicious cycle that just doesn't end unless you can break that. So now what does it mean for APIs? Couple this with issues of access for APIs. And I don't want to just say for APIs only. This is for a lot of, first generation Americans, refugees, immigrants. And we also actually want to talk about the cultural poverty that is embedded in this. So when I say, you know, I don't want to just only say that those poverty issues are very specific to people of color, and we do see a lot of other communities and white communities who are poor as well. But couple that with these issues of access, culture. If you're a refugee immigrant, if you have language access issues, and if you're in social isolation as an immigrant and you just never learn English, you don't know where to go to learn English, you're going to have major, major barriers to overcome. Culturally specific healthcare providers, a lot of insurance coverage, a lot of insurance companies don't cover acupuncture, don't cover traditional Chinese medicine. You know, that's a big issue. Documentation, which Mr. Moreno will be talking about shortly as well. So, you know, documentation, there is also, APIs can be undocumented immigrants as well. It's, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions and about APIs. Affordability of care, again, poverty. Preventive care, API women have very, very low rates of access to preventive care. Mammogram, they have one of the highest rates of very little or no access to mammogram and pap smears. So you have high rates of cervical cancer and breast cancer. And when they go to the doctor and the doctor tells them, well, you're Asian, you can't get breast cancer. So there you go. And I'm going to take this chance to dispel the myth. The model minority is a myth. Let me tell you. So let's see. APIs are not monocultural. We encompass over 50 countries in Asia. In China alone, there's 55 recognized ethnic groups. So that's one Asian country, 55 ethnic groups. And then you count Pacific Islands, there's 16 plus Pacific Island countries, and then you have, it's incredible, Native Hawaiian. And there's very little data collection on all of those ethnic groups. That's the problem, is that we don't know exactly what the trends are, but we can make these larger trends from, as you could have seen in the data I gave you before. We're not all good at math and science. I'm terrible at it. I prefer art, actually, and my mom hated that. Cultural stigmas around mental health. So mental health issues we really don't talk about when we talk about health reform, because I think more of the idea is around just going to the physician for, you know, your family doctor for preventive care. But mental health is also, we've tried to make it as part of the conversation because it's such a big issue in our API community, is that there is a stigma that you don't talk about it. You go to the doctor can ask you, you know, are you depressed? Do you have any issues? Have you, you know, when they ask you the symptom questions for depression, they're all going to say no. There is, you know, there needs to be a way that's culturally specific to get that answer out of the patients. And yes, we do have health problems. We're people. So how we are organizing around health reform or trying to achieve health equity. So our issue areas this time around is the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange. We see this as a vehicle for achieving health equity. Language access issues become major barriers for our community. So trying to make this as a vehicle by setting cultural competency standards and really trying to make it easier for our communities who need this culturally specific care to be able to see that in the exchange market. So, you know, if a certain insurance company is particularly really good at providing culturally specific care, just put a little star by them. Then, you know where to go, so you have a way to access it. And then cultural competency continuing education. Right now there is a Senate bill, I believe it's Senate Bill 97, that we're also organizing around for healthcare providers. This is extremely important, and we're talking about good quality care in terms of cultural competence. It's not about, you know, learning to speak another language, being able to profile, see your patient come in and say, oh, that person's Asian, they're definitely Chinese. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about cultural competence. We're talking about, you know, patient-centered care. That's what it is. It's being able to ask the right questions or allow the patient the right to self-identify and go off of that. Granular level data collection. Again, one of the biggest issues in the API community, you have all of these subgroups, 50 plus Asian countries, 16 plus Pacific Islander countries, Native Hawaiians. We don't have enough data on them. You need data to be able to say that there's evidence-based practice, right? So when we talk about, you know, I was reading through the action plan in the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange. They talk about evidence-based practice a lot, except there is no evidence for APIs. You know, we can say there are promising practices based on, you know, certain community centers, community health centers, but we can't say that there is really hard evidence to inform a lot of, you know, how to treat certain conditions or what conditions are prevalent is kind of another cultural competency measure. So then the next one. So we have Health Equity and Reform Team, HEART. It's very telling of what we're trying to do. We do policy research, we do education, and we do community-based advocacy. So we really try to engage our API communities into working for health equity. So we've also worked with coalitions and doing policy advocacy and trying to engage our community more into the policy-making and policy-shaping process. So we also work with the People of Color Health Equity Collaborative and the Health Equity Policy Review Committee through the Office of Multicultural Health Services. So common misconceptions about cultural competency, what does it mean? It's not about speaking another language. It's not about being able to identify every single person that comes through your office door. It's not about, you know, being able to profile on the first look. It's, again, as I said before, it's about patient-centered care. It's about, you know, knowing what family structures are like or being able to, you know, start that conversation, because it's a conversation that a lot of people don't want to talk about. You don't want to ask, how do you identify? You don't want to ask, are you, you know, because the first question is usually, are you Chinese? Not, how do you identify? And those are two very different forms of questions. So what does linguistic competence mean? A lot of these issues I'm addressing because it came up in our cultural competency continuing education bill, our discussion. And a lot of people were thinking that linguistic competency means that you have to be bilingual. That's not the case. We're not asking providers to be bilingual. We're asking them to know that children cannot interpret for their parents. A lot of parents who don't speak English take their children into the hospital room with them. And these children don't have the medical terms. They may be bilingual in the, they can converse. They can talk about politics. Maybe they can talk about school. But medical terms are very specific, even for people who speak English fluently, right? I mean, I can go into the doctor, and the doctor can tell me what's, you know, whatever they want to tell me, but I won't understand half the things they say. I have to ask them to say it in my terms. So when we talk about linguistic competence, you know, just a quick story about that. I've been interpreting for my mother since I was in high school. And, you know, for the longest time, the physician would just be like, oh, you want to interpret for your mother? That's awesome. That's great. Yeah, come on in. Except for the longest time, every time the physician asked me, does your mother have any symptoms of depression? You know, is she sleeping? Is she eating? I'm just like, no, of course not. My mother, no way. What child wants to, you know, acknowledge that in their parents, right? For the longest time, we put our parents on a pedestal for a while. Maybe we don't. But, you know, nobody wants to say that. No daughter wants to say that about their mother. And, you know, hepatitis B is highly, highly prevalent in Asian API communities. It's just particularly the case for Koreans. And for the longest time, my mom went to a doctor who just never really acknowledged the pain she had in her liver. And then just recently, we switched providers because we had heard about her, you know, cultural competency trends. I don't want to say that she was incredibly so great that she was, you know, she could speak Korean and everything. But, you know, she, for the first time, she asked my mom when my mom complained about liver problems or her pain where her liver was. She said, you know, Koreans actually have high prevalence rates of hepatitis B. Have you been tested for it? My mom said, well, that's the first. In how many years that she's been going to the doctor, the first time a physician asked her because she knew the cultural background of, you know, of the conditions that were prevalent in our communities. And so what it means for APIs, it means better language access. It means better care, improved communications. So you're, you know, really just a lot of things that can, you know, just by doing these things that we talked about, you know, it's so many things can be improved. You're talking about improved health, better outcomes. So in the long term, that's what our goal is. It's to achieve health equity. So I'd just like to thank you for your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I just wanted to let you know that after the panel, we're going to have a section of questions and answers. So get ready for that after they speak. Now we're going to have Alberto Moreno.
Good morning. No, that's not working. Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Wow, what a robust response. Thank you. And it's early on a Saturday morning. You know, they've asked me here to come speak with you about Latino health disparities and Latinos in general, both maybe nationally and then specifically here in Oregon. My name is Alberto Moreno, and I'm the Migrant Health Coordinator for the state of Oregon, which means that my job is to travel the state to help seed new federally qualified health centers, but specifically migrant health centers for Oregon's 175,000 migrant seasonal farm workers in the state. And so it is a privilege for me to be here with you this morning. But more than a privilege, I just wanted to reflect on your presence today. most of us go into community every single day, and it's generally work that we do often in isolation from each other. But we also feel a kind of cultural isolation because we feel that we have to carry the water for our communities. And that work often feels lonely because we feel that we're doing it alone. And when I walked into this room this morning, I have to tell you that your presence to me here today is restorative. And what I mean to say by that is that walking in this morning, I did not feel that I was doing this work alone. I no longer felt that we were in this fight alone by ourselves. And so I want to thank you for your presence this morning, for your intention, but more importantly, for the great work that I know you're about to do once you're released from this great hall. But Margaret wanted me to tell you a little bit about Latinos. Some of you know that it's the fastest growing community in the U.S. and then here locally as well. In fact, there are over 42.7 billion, I'm sorry, that would be impressive, yes. And not only would you be impressed, but you should have reason for concern. Let me take that back. There's already enough concern going around this population in any event, so I don't need to add to it. So relax, breathe. It's only 42.7 million Latinos in the U.S., which is still a substantial figure. I don't mean to minimize it either. 67% of these are of Mexican origin, and I have a PowerPoint presentation which I'm supposed to be doing, but we're just going to ignore it. I'm more interested in having a conversation with you this morning. But what often doesn't get talked about is the power behind this community. We often hear a discussion about how many resources this community uses, takes up, consumes. Consumer is one of my least favorite terms because it suggests to us that someone is consuming something of value that belongs to us. And so I resent that term. And it should be taken out of our vernacular. But would you be surprised to learn that Latinos wield over $580 billion in buying power, according to the 2002 U.S. Census? That undocumented workers, by the way, you hear a great deal of discussion around this population, undocumented workers, otherwise known as legals. Would you be surprised to hear that undocumented workers generate goods and services worth more than $120 billion a year in the U.S., or that documented and undocumented Mexican immigrants pay $25 to $30 billion in taxes each year, but only 5% of these receive public assistance? Although these workers are highly productive and make substantial contributions to our economy, 70%, for example, of agriculture workers do not have health insurance. And in Oregon, I should tell you that in Oregon, there were 360,000 Latinos or Hispanics in the last U.S. Census. We anticipate that for this U.S. Census, that figure will reach, if not exceed, 500,000 Latinos in the state, representing 10% of the total population and the largest minority in the state. That Hispanic population almost doubled between 1990 and 2005. It is projected that there will be more than 100 million Hispanics in 2050, constituting about 25% of the total population. That 64% of Hispanic households are of Mexican origin, and the median age of Hispanics is 27 years, or 9 years younger than the median age of the total population. By the way, even if you are concerned, even if you are concerned about the fact that there are 42.7 million Latinos in the U.S., one of the current dilemmas that we're having in our healthcare system is that by the time most of you reach retirement age, Social Security will be bankrupt. And so it so much depends that there's some debate on the floor. Has to cut its benefits significantly. Yes. We have consensus, yes? Oh, we don't. There's no consensus. Okay, all right.
Everybody has to pay their share.
Thank
you.
My apologies for stirring up what appears to be a point of division in this otherwise unified group. The point I was trying to make, and thank you for bearing it out with me, is what were to happen if we were to legalize that community? Wouldn't it be great then, because they would then be contributing significantly to the tax base,
yes.
Which would solve our,
yes?
Some of our deficit problems?
Yes.
Anyway, that's all I was trying to say. Unfortunately, it also falls upon me to tell you that even though this community is highly productive, that we also have some of the worst health outcomes. So, for example, did you know that 1.2 million Mexicans in the U.S. have been diagnosed with diabetes? Or that cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death among Latinos nationwide? And that despite high levels of employment, nearly 60% of Latinos, nearly 60% live in families with incomes below 200% of the poverty level, compared, by the way, to 23% of whites. Did you know that the risk of tuberculosis among farm workers was estimated to be 6 times greater than the general population? And I would be remiss if I didn't talk with you today as the migrant health coordinator about migrant and seasonal farm workers in our state. For example, did you know that they are among the most disadvantaged medically indigent persons and have the poorest health group in the U.S.? That the infant mortality among migrant farm workers is 25% higher than the general population? By the way, this fact alone is the one thing that keeps me up at night. I should tell you that every night I wake up at around 3 a.m. And the thought, the discussion in my brain is, how do I communicate this to Americans? How do I communicate the import of this to Oregonians? That 25% more of our children are dying simply because of their race or because of their occupation. And so it is hard for me to sleep through that fact, through that disparity. They also have lower height and weight, higher rate of respiratory disease, parasitic conditions, skin infection, chronic diarrhea, vitamin A deficiency, accidental injury, heat-related illness, chemical poisoning, just to name a few. And by the way, dental care, even more difficult to obtain for this population than primary medical care. In fact, the League of Women Voters in Oregon have said that dental care for this population is comparable to third world care.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I am aware of, given the fact that this language I'm speaking to you with is not my first language, is this notion of language as something that reveals or obscures the meaning of things. Right? And what do I mean by this? I mean that sometimes our diction can be used to reveal something about the nature of who we are, and sometimes it can be used to obscure it. And what I mean to say to you is that when I talk about the dental health of this community comparing to third world country, what it looks like is that when we go out to the migrant camps and we do dental outreach, we have had gentlemen come up to us, women and men, but I'm speaking now of one particular gentleman who came to us. He was about 68. And he came to us because he was having trouble chewing his food. By the way, he's 68 and still working in the migrant camps. Yes? He comes to us and he's having trouble chewing his food and is hoping that we can make him a bridge for his teeth. He didn't have any teeth at the bottom. And so the dentist said, have him come over here. And I was translating. I was translating, and the dentist asked him what happened to his left lower canine, this tooth here. And the gentleman told me this story, which I hope tells you more about what I'm trying to say to you. He says, I had a toothache, went to the dentist, they wanted $300 up front, and I didn't have the money. I went to the hospital, they couldn't do anything for me. Everywhere I went, I was turned away. But it hurt so bad, I came home, took a pair of pliers, and tried to pull it out myself. The reason I'm telling you this story is because in the process of trying to pull out his own tooth with a pair of pliers, he broke his tooth. And we were unable that day to make him a bridge to help with his eating, yes? And so that's what I mean about the power of language to either reveal or obscure the reality of our lives. And I wanted to give you that very real example that also stays with me. But I want to end our conversation here because you may be asking, why do we care about all these health disparities? Why should we be concerned? Why didn't so many of the questions that we ask, actually, or more interestingly, so many of the questions that we don't ask are informed by our own privilege. Does that make sense? And so would you be surprised to learn that most of you in this room have the good grace to be able to live to the age of 73 on average? You'll all, on average, the women get to live longer because they've been good. Men, you have to speak to your demographic. I think somewhere in their previous lives, they were probably better behaved than we were. So they get to live a little bit longer, as I recall. But the average lifespan for you in this room is about 73 years of age. And the reason I mention this to you is because the question is, how do these health disparities conserve on a human frame, right? How do they conserve on a human life? What is the sum total of these inequalities? The lack of access to health care, the lack of access to prenatal care. By the way, Oregon does not provide prenatal care to all women in the state. California and Washington does. Specifically, undocumented women do not have a right to seek prenatal care. And did you know, by the way, that undocumented children in the state are not eligible for the Health Care for All Kids bill that recently passed, that they were intentionally left out? And I say this to you because I don't think that's who we're meant to be. I don't think, and I may be mistaken, and many of you here are a little bit older than I am, so your counsel is welcomed, but I don't think that's who we're meant to be. I don't think that that represents the great promise of this nation, that the promise of the state does not lie, is not fulfilled in us punishing our children for the decision that our parents made. I don't believe that that is who we are, who we're meant to be, both as a nation and as this great state. But I want to end my comments now by telling you that the way these health disparities conserve on a human life is that because of all these inequities, social and health and otherwise, migrant and seasonal farm workers have a life expectancy of 49 years. Those of you who are doing the math, that means that you get to live 24 years more than this community does. And if you multiply that, the answer to that question is all these health disparities, all these inequities conserve on a human life to the sum of 24 years multiplied 3 to 5 million times over. And so I know that you share with me in this room the belief and the value that it is not right, that it is not just, and that you will commit yourselves forward from this day as you have to today to change that reality. Because when we don't have equity, there is something about our very own spirit that cannot find peace and equity. And so I want to again thank you for your presence, for your intention, for your goodwill and your good work, and thank you for listening to us.
Thank you, Alberto. Now let's have Michael Ward.
Good morning, I too am glad to see so many allies in the work. My name is Michael Ware. I'm the policy coordinator for Oregon Health Equity. I'm the new kid on the block. Oregon Health Equity is a collaborative of several organizations of social that are working on social justice issues. One of them is PoCheck. I'm here because one of the issues that we're concerned with as well is single payer. But I wanted to share with you some of the other things that we're interested in and try to leave some time for questions and answers for all of us. But first of all, the goals of our organization is to do some research and education on health equity and disparity issues. We want to develop policy and agendas and priorities around budget. And we want to formalize and sustain some type of long-term community-based advocacy network. We've decided on focusing on six legislative issues this session. Three of them social, economic injustice, and the other health. Those issues are the earned income tax credit, the equal pay or equal work legislation, the Oregon State Bank, the cultural competency training for licensed health care providers, the state health exchange, and healthy kids. We think those are programs that really are going, or legislation that is really going to affect people of color, and we want to help deepen the analyzation and the work and conversation around those. So with that, I want to open it up for questions from any one of us.
Thank you. I'm going to explain a little bit how we're going to deal with the questions. We're going to have somebody with microphones, right? It's there. Oh, it's here, please. I'm sorry. Here. So we're going to try to have, like, by sectors. So if there's many people raising their hand, we just get one. We don't have a lot of time to do everyone, but we're going to have one person per each one of these sectors here. So go ahead, please.
Okay. My background is engineering and legal, and specifically systems engineering. Okay. My opinion is that unless you get out of the ideology stage, you won't be able to do a good presentation to the people of Oregon. So saying single payer is great, and it may result in newsprint, okay? But what does it mean to the people of Oregon? How do you translate single payer to a workable system on the street? Number two, the legal part of it is how do you justify what you can accomplish in Oregon legally? And I'm talking about a constitutional amendment similar to that for equal rights for women that would provide equal rights under governmental health care for everybody in the country. That would include immigrants. So ideology, how do we break out of that? Okay. Systems engineering, give me a system that works, that's based on current technologies, current practice, and interface it with research organizations, operations worldwide. How do you do that?
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks. Before we continue, I just want to update you on the time. We're getting a little short in the time, so we're not going to have a lot of opportunities for that for more longer time. And we have more opportunities going back to the work that we have throughout the day. So there's a lot of opportunities there to cover a lot of different issues. And I want to remind that this part of the panel is especially about health equity and what they can respond to that. So do you want to respond, any of you, to or comment about the last question?
Well, I just, in response, I think we do need to do a lot of education and advocacy around defining what we mean by single payer and all the other things that I've mentioned. And that's the purpose of, coming to groups like this and, to doing community forums, which is what we've been involved in. So I agree with you.
Thank you very much. There's one person up there.
I think that's actually an excellent question. I think the answer is, I think we do it all. We have created, I think many of our problems are born from this, what I would refer to as this myth of separateness, right? And then that creates an environment of competition. And this notion that our interests are separate and disparate, and therefore a natural competition with each other is a myth we need to challenge. And so I think we do that. We make sure that whatever net we design is a net that protects everybody, that carries everybody forward, irrespective of race. Yes? So that it's based on need. And it isn't predicated on color, which is the system we have right now. And so we do it for everybody. And I think your question is a great question. I'm glad you've asked it. Thank you.
I'd like to add to that. When I was talking about the social determinants of health and talking about the culture of poverty, that was the point I was trying to make, was that by tackling poverty and by tackling all these social determinants of health, we're not just focusing on communities of color, but we're focusing on people who are poor, who need the same access. We're just saying that there are different barriers or more barriers for a certain community or another that are tacked on to poverty because of, say, race, ethnicity, language. But by tackling poverty and social determinants of health, we're hoping that we can take a kind of a holistic approach and a systemic approach for a systemic change.
Yeah. And we're going to, we're going to have just one more question. And I apologize again for the lack of time that we have, and that we save some of those questions and other things that we want to do for the groups. The time is approaching, and we're just going to have one. So I'll appreciate it if you
guys... had one comment. There's a book called The Spirit Level, which talks about inequality within the industrialized world. Suggests that's the core problem with all the other issues of health care and trust levels and us versus them kind of thing. So we may have to go deeper, which is to work at inequality. Second question, what is the cultural competency legislation number?
I'm putting my state code back on. The legislative bill is Senate Bill 97 that promotes cultural and linguistic competency for providers. And so the idea is to make sure that medical providers receive continuing education and training around cultural competency, that new students, as they're being educated, also receive that training, so that when they get to be practicing providers, the care they provide is more culturally relevant and culturally meaningful. And by the way, a great deal is said about cultural competency, and we never have the discussion that the bulk of that benefit comes from us inventorying our own culture and our own values and how those interface with others. Marco, you're sorry. Okay.
Thank you very much. Well, as I said, we're going to leave it with the two of you. We're going to honor you, and I'll appreciate if it's short, and then we can have, as I'm saying, there's a lot of things that are going to be talked about in the other groups, and save also time and questions for that. So please, if you can do
it. I'll just make it short. One of the things I see, and one of the things that we have to look at, and your panels brought up something that I very... hold dear to me. I think we need to look at how we, as a culture in the United States, look at different nationalities and different people. I am very tired of the divisiveness in this country. We need, as Americans, to come together and unify. It's not only with healthcare. I'm seeing it in all shapes and forms of things. We have a great country, and the part of the problem we have in this country is we don't. We try to do something, and then we divide each other by getting to the means. We need to look at being culturally sensitive in how we present things and everything. And I think this should be part of the immigration reform thing. I know that we talked about it in this and the Social Security thing. We need to be mindful that there are other people of different nationalities and different races. And I think sometimes we forget that. As being an old person myself, I grew up in the big city in Los Angeles, where I was exposed to different people of nationalities. I was thankful for that education. And I think we need to make sure that our rural people are connecting, too. I just wanted to say my one question here is how the state is going through major budgetary problems right now. I am concerned that if we don't work together on this, we will lose the ground. We've been working very hard. I know Governor Kitzhaber has the Oregon Health Plan. They are talking about major cutbacks. That's going to affect minorities. It's going to affect white people. It's going to affect everybody. We need to make sure that we can keep what's in place, the safety nets, without losing ground. That's my major question.
Thank you. Thanks. The next. Go ahead. We're going to do it, the two of you at once.
Good morning. My name is Sandra Hernandez. I am with the Tree Institute, one of the founders of the PoCheck. So I'm so happy that our colleagues and partners are here today. And thank you so much for hearing us and having the attention. What I just want to make is a point that we, together with other small communities and organizations from Salem, Woodburn, Hood River, of Latinos, we really decide to create a way of talking about health equity in terms of the majority. The health equity is not for us as minority communities. It's about all of us. Because, and that was great when a couple of months ago in this meeting here in Portland with the Oregon Health Policy Board, Oregon Health Authority, we have some people just bringing the issue, oh, you know, we are talking about health equity, and that's just for smaller communities. But, and then we came, no, listen, and that really create this legislative forum theater to all of us to be aware and really work together. The health equity is for the health of the majority. That's all, and thank you so much.
All right, thanks. Any comments from any of you?
So I just wanted to make a plug for a couple of our advocacy efforts. So Senate Bill 97 is a cultural competency bill that's going through the Senate right now. So I would really encourage you to please go and, you know, advocate for this bill. It's incredibly important for all of our communities. It's not just about people of color. It's about, again, cultural poverty as well. So it would, you know, just really eliminate a lot of access barriers. The second one is the Health Equity Policy Review Committee is... It's kind of charged by the Oregon Health Policy Board, whether it was by coercion or not. I don't know if, you know, it really was a choice, but it's actually, you know, a great way for the government to engage communities from very diverse backgrounds and really, you know, get in touch with the grassroots to a state level and just make that connection. And what they've done is actually through the end of February, they'll eliminate the charge of the committee. And so health equity has only been, this Health Equity Policy Review Committee has only had this charge for, I don't know, August through February, was it? Something like that. It was a very short time frame anyway. So what I really encourage you to do also is if, you know, read up on this committee. You can find it, I believe, on the Office of Multicultural Health Services website. And it does an incredible, you know, outreach to these communities, to all of our communities. So please advocate for this continued charge because once it's gone, you know, the Health Policy Board has said this is something, equity should be embedded in everything, in all of our communities, but it's, you know, something that we do really have to think about. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Just two things I want to put out after this. One is that I want to echo again the word about educate. And that means educate everyone else, but also ourselves, about one important thing, especially in terms of equity. We need to understand the root causes of why we are a diverse community, the root causes why we have people of color in our community, the root causes of why we have immigrants coming to this this country. And understand that first, then to say, oh, are we part of the same community? Do we have a same history here that's happening from more than 500 years and that we're just now at this point, but we really deny the history that we have? So the second part is that we need to look at us as one community, which is very hard for all of us. We need to look at us as one movement. Thank you. But for that, we need to build it with intention that we have. So we go back to our communities, our groups and organizations, and start doing that. And now, let's continue because we have to go back to the work, right?
Thank you, Marco. Let's thank all our panelists for an excellent session. You know, Marco's remarks reminded me that my brother's really into this ancestry and history stuff, and he's looked up all kinds of stuff, and I'm pretty sure many of my ancestors are undocumented. So, I regret to tell you, as a physician, I ought to speak Spanish, but I don't. I do know these three words, todos somos inmigrantes. We are all immigrants. We're all in this together. Now, it's time to move on to the breakouts. I just want to give you some, it's time for our break for about 15 minutes, and at 10:45, we're going to have our single-payer in-focus breakouts. A couple of announcements about that. First of all, at 10:45 are the breakouts. At noon, we're going to stop for lunch. At 1 o'clock, we reconvene here for a speech by Congressman Conyers. Let me tell you about the breakouts. Single Payer 101 is in the sanctuary room. This room. The labor breakout is in Buchanan Building, room 101. And you can look in your program. I believe there's a map. Next building that way, Buchanan Building? Okay. And look in your program and you can see a description of these groups. The Faith-Based Organizations Group is in Buchanan Building, room 203. The Homelessness and Poverty Focus Group is in the Daisy Bingham Room, which is downstairs next to Fuller Hall. That's a change from what's in the program, the Daisy Bingham Room.
And the undocumented workers, PPACA and single payer, is over in Buchanan, room 201. So with that, it's time for our break, and in 15 minutes, convene for the focus groups. Let's thank all the speakers for a wonderful morning.